We're going to pick right up. I think we'll be able to slow down a little bit tonight. We've been going pretty fast, but we're just covering two chapters tonight. And God is going to present himself after hearing all this debate that's been going on for several cycles, and he's going to have some questions for Job specifically. And you might recall earlier, and just in retrospect, there were several times Job was perplexed why he was suffering the things he was suffering. And as we talked in class, you might recall, the only thing he could deduct it had to be God, because no one else had that kind of power. He doesn't seem to recognize the presence of Satan. And so he lays a lot of charges at God's feet. And we're going to see God continue to rebuff that from here on to the end of the book, until Job finally repents. But we're going to get started right in chapter 38. And so God actually starts the, this is where we're at right here in our outline in the yellow. And then God actually starts here, and it says, "The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." If I could get a reader to read just the first, let's see here. Let's go with the first seven verses. And then we'll go from there. So, Bruce, okay.
Chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you will instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who said it's its measurements? That you know, or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy."
Okay, so God starts off with creation. And what he does here is we're going to start off with the inanimate world. In other words, God's going to talk about the things that are inanimate, things like the dawn, the sea, the hail, the lightning, the rain, things like that. And that's in most of chapter 38. And then he's going to switch over and give nine more examples of animate examples. So examples of some of his created animals. So we're going to start off with inanimate. And so in verses 1 through 7, what Bruce just read, he talks about creation itself. And so he basically asked God, "Job, where were you at when I, as the creator, put everything together?" God is the builder, he's the potter, he's the weaver, he's the designer of all things. And so he asked Job, "You know, when I laid all the foundations of the earth and I did all these things, where were you at?" And again, this is going to be a lot of rebuke to Job, because Job has continuously throughout the book wanted to challenge God and challenge his ability to rule and make good decisions, because after all, God had made a bad decision about him. And so God is going to challenge Job in several areas. There's a lot of verses, I've got these in your handouts, that talk about God being the builder of all things, and specifically creation. Psalms 24. Isaiah 40, Isaiah 45, Job chapter 26 earlier, Colossians 1:16. They all talk about the fact that God is the master designer, the weaver, the creator of all things. And so that's his first example to Job. And so then he's going to move on now to the ocean and the seas. So if I can get someone else to read verses 8 through 11, this is about the seas. Okay, Marv. Okay, so the next example that God gives to Job here is who shut the sea in with some doors. And when you think about it, what he's saying is, you know, the oceans have a place where they are at. They are in the beds that they lie in. They will reach to a certain point on the shoreline, and then they go no farther. And so God asks Job the question of where were you at when I fixed the limits? And I set the doors, and I set the bars, and I told the waves, you will come no farther. And so very fascinating language that he uses here. I'll have some things in here that are from, help me out, BJ, with his name.
Arnold Schnabel,
who has God spoken, and then the other side says God has spoken. This is one of the examples out of that book, but they have discovered that indeed the seas do have a boundary. They lie in a bed that's been created for them, and this was actually discovered with some of the bathyspheres and some of the other things they use when they do oceanographic research back in 1960. And the oceans do lie indeed in a bed, and that's where they are to reside and are located, and they go no farther. They come as far as the shoreline, and that's where the waves will stop. And so God gives Job his second example of creation, and now this massive bodies of water that cover two-thirds of our world. And so, okay, a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm. And taught us that they sing. Here it is again.
Yeah.
They sing.
The stars sing. They do make a singing noise, yeah. This is amazing stuff. That's a fabulous book. We have it back there if you guys ever want to get a copy of it. There it's God Has Spoken. Bruce, I think you had your hand up.
When I read this thought, these four gentlemen or five gentlemen have been bantering back and forth. And then this whirlwind comes. And God's voice comes out of it. That had to be an impact. I mean, I'm sure they fell down on their face, and now they're hearing this while they're contemplating, what did we do to bring God into this? And now...
This is the climax, and what Bruce is saying is exactly right. Get you just a second, BJ, is that God now stands up and speaks, and later, we'll find next week when we finish up the book, Job doesn't even care anymore about his sufferings. Job states, you know, before I heard you, now I have seen you, and he was at peace. He didn't even ask about his sufferings anymore, you know, because he realized he did have God as a friend. God loved him. God cared about him. And so we'll find out that just the presence of God in front of him was enough, you know. BJ, you had a...
irony behind how God begins this as well, because these gentlemen have been arguing about who's older and therefore who's wiser, and that they get their wisdom from the Creator, and yet God here begins his speech by asking how many of you were old enough to be there when I was there,
right?
And oh, by the way, I am that Creator. And there's just some irony, because they were trying to make their argument greater by claiming age and by claiming that it's from the Creator, the wisdom. And now the Creator is going to speak himself, and the first thing he asks is, how old are you? And, were you there when I did this? And of course the answer is no. And so it seems that God in some ways is almost through wisdom mocking these men and mocking Job. Really, truth has a way of doing that to people.
It does, and he's doing his 101 questions, as I call it. And basically, it's to humble the three friends of Job and Elihu and the rest of them that are there present. If you notice when God starts off this in the coming out of the whirlwind, he says, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" Keep that in mind, because that gets referred to at the end of the book too. Job says, "I'm the one who spoke without knowledge." And so you have it kind of like bookended at both ends. So anyway, this was discovered actually in 1960 by a scientific bathyspheres. And so exactly what God said in the book of Job some 3,000 years ago, however old the book is. Next one is going to be God talks about the dawn. And so if I can get someone to read verses 12 through 15, that'll be your next one. Steve, you want to get that for us?
"Have you ever in your life commanded the morning and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and they stand forth like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and the uplifted arms is broken.
Okay. This seems to describe from God the sunrise as God describes it like the removal of dark robes that have shielded the night from the world, and it exposes the wicked who have been sheltering underneath of the cover of darkness. And we all know this. We hear it in society. Most crimes are not committed in broad daylight. Most crimes, most adulteries, most, you know, drunkenness, most revelries, things always happen at night under the cover of darkness. And so the language that is used here by God is saying it's like the sunrise is the removal of this dark cloak from the world, and it exposes, the wicked have been sheltering under the cover of darkness. So this is the dawn. And just I put as a note in here for you is that Christians are referred to as children of light. And so something to think about. But that is God's... Next question is about the dawn itself. Okay. All right, we're going to move on to the next one, which is another one that is covered by Arnold Schnabel in his book. And it's the Springs of the Sea. And if I can get someone to read that one, that's a short one, 16 through 18. Who'd like to read that for us? Okay, John. Okay, so from the creation to the ocean to the dawn, and now God moves on to the springs of the sea, and these have actually been found. They found these springs down in very deep areas in the Marianas Trench and other abysses that are very, very deep in the ocean. They actually have warm water springs that spring out. And I'll get right to you in just a second, Clint. And one of the things they've discovered is these long tube worms that live down there at tremendous depth where usually nothing could be or could exist. And it's because of this warm water that comes out of these springs at very, very deep depth. And that was discovered in 1930, and they continued finding more of it up through 1945. So again, another reference to something God spoke of a long time ago. Clint. Yeah, clams, and there's these very large tube worms, and you can Google this and just put, springs or tube worms, and you'll see pictures of these that they have taken these deep submersibles down and got pictures of them. Yeah.
There was an article online today that the gases and minerals in these springs are critical to the life of the animals and plants
that are there, right. It's like a small little ecosystem at a very, very deep depth. And again, it's only the designer could know this. And again, they discovered it, science discovered it in 1930s, 1940s. It's been written in Job since 3,000 years ago. So it's been around for a long time. So God goes then now from the springs of the sea, he moves on again to the next inanimate object, and he talks about here the dwelling of light. And if I can get someone to read 19 through 21, another short reading. Anybody like to read it? BJ?
Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the paths to its home? For you were born then, and the number of your days is great.
Okay, so a little bit of mockery here from God. Job, you must know it all, and you've been around forever, and you must know how the light and darkness are separated, and you must have been born back then. So you tell me about this, Job. How does the dwelling of light exist, and how does this is all separated? God in Genesis, if you recall in Genesis chapter 1, God talks about separating the light from the darkness, and it was good, and that's exactly what he's referring to here. He assigned to each a distinct realm. There's the realm of darkness, and then there's the realm of light. And again, there is some rhetorical questions here for Job. Again, it's to humble Job and to make him realize he had ventured out and laid things at God's feet that were inappropriate. And we're going to see it come more and more, even when we get into chapters 40 and 41. He's going to really press hard on Job, not to be mean, but to get Job to repent. And we're going to see a lot of similarities. And BJ, I know if you're here, you can help me out with this. There's so many similarities to Job and Christ. And we're going to try to point some of those out next week too. But he's going to try to get Job to realize he stepped in boundaries he shouldn't have stepped. So, dwelling of light, that's the next one. God then goes and talks about the snow and the hail. And he talks about these that are things that he keeps in his treasuries. And I'll read that one in verses 22 through 24. God says to Job, he says, "Have you entered the treasuries of the snow, or have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and of war? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth?" So God here talks about the these treasuries that are much like we would store up gold in a treasury. They are ready for God's use. He refers to it possibly in wartime. And we see some references to some of these things in Joshua 10, Judges 5, and 1 Samuel 7. So sometimes God has used what we would call natural type weather events to create the outcome, the desired outcome in a war or a battle. And so the question again for Job is, Job, tell me about your treasuries. What treasuries have you laid up? Because I've laid up treasuries of snow and treasuries of hail for my purpose and to achieve my results. And so, again, and these are all rhetorical, and Job is not going to open his mouth. There's not going to be a single word spoken until we get much later when God actually prompts him and says, you know, answer me. And so God is going to continue on with his 101 questions. Okay, the next inanimate object is the rain and the lightning and the thunder. And this is just about five or six verses. I guess I'm going to read 25 through 30. Okay, Kevin, thank you. Okay, so God here refers to lightning, thunder, rain, and God created all these things. And it's interesting, he talks about the lightning here to satisfy, has the rain of Father who has begotten drops of dew and so forth. One of the interesting things that is mentioned earlier in verse 25, he says, "Who has divided the channel for the overflowing water, or a pathway for the thunderbolt?" They have science has discovered the fact that a lightning bolt or a thunderbolt, an electrical charge, is absolutely required to cause the polarity of the water droplets to change, which lets the raindrops turn loose from the clouds and actually fall to the earth. And so there is a pathway for this lightning, and this lightning is needed to cause the water to be released from the clouds, which are saturated. And again, this water cycle is described by God here. This was discovered in 1930 and by science. And of course, Job talks about it 3,000 years ago. So you're going to see a lot of these over and over again, where God is telling us things that only a designer, only a creator would know, and tells Job and his friends from way back. Any questions on that before we move on? Okay, next one's going to be the heavenly bodies. And this is 31 through 33. He says in verse 31 to Job, "Can you bind the cluster of Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season? Can you guide the great bear with its cubs? And do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominions over the earth. And so God here is referring to heavenly bodies, all part of God's tapestry and the creation of the skies. And here he turns to some examples of the constellations. And these are ones we still refer to, even in modern astronomy. He talks about Pleiades and Orion. And so these are things that God points out and says, you know, Job, where were you when I, you know, put the tapestry in the heavens and created all these stars of light and all these constellations? Where were you at? And so, again, another example of God's magnificent design. John?
Are these the same constellations that we identified?
I'm going to have to assume so. I didn't actually check that, but I would assume, you know, the commentary says this is what they equate to. So I'm going to have to go with yes, probably. And again, all by the hand of a designer and all part of the tapestry of his creation. So really exciting things. He moves on to, I think it's just one more, which is the clouds and the rain. And this is in verses 34 through 38. If I can get someone to read that for us. This talks a little bit more about the water cycle. Anybody? BJ? Okay.
Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? And can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? Or who can number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can tilt the waterskins of heaven when the dust grinds into a mass and the clods stick fast together?
Okay, so again, this is another reference, I believe, to the water cycle itself. And again, the lightning is mentioned that speaks and the rain is released. And he asks a very interesting question, and it's impossible to answer, but who can number the clouds? You know, clouds are all over the earth. They break up into smaller clouds and larger clouds. And God says, who can number them? And then God also then describes the fact that it is he, through this water cycle, gives life to his creation that's on the earth. And so to maintain this continuity and balance of life, for all creation. So these are just, I mean, God could have gone on for hours with the things he's created that are inanimate, but he uses, for whatever reason, these nine examples. And so these are things that Job is to consider, his magnificence and his sovereignty as a designer and as a creator. So these are the nine things that are in the inanimate world. BJ.
In verse 36, I think it's really interesting that you have something different out here, and he says, who has put wisdom in the inward parts, and who has given understanding to the mind? And one of the biggest arguments for apologetics is, when you look at, and we've talked about this in the back of college class, Kevin could probably do a better job of talking about this, we can pick up when I'm done, but DNA, the way that it's coded, and the way that it passes things on, it's information, and information has to come from somewhere. And, you know, it has to come from intelligence, bottom line. And, you know, and so that's basically what we're reading about here as well in verse 36.
Kevin, you can fix what I
said. Yeah. And if you want to sum up all these things God has pointed out, it's, Job, this is all design. I'm the designer. And so it's all to point that out to Job. And to humble him, because his rhetorical questions are, where were you when I did all this? Why are you, you know, trying to judge me? And so he's going to move on, though. He doesn't stop with the inanimate. He moves on now right immediately, and there's a somewhat of a chapter break here. I don't know if it's by design, but there's a chapter break really where there shouldn't be. But he moves right on into verse 39, and God now starts with nine examples of the animal world or the animate world. And so one of the first creatures he talks about is the lioness and her whelps. And so beginning in verse 39. Come on, want to read that for me? 39 through 41. Thank you, Bruce.
Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their lair? Who prepares for the raven its nourishment when it's young cries to God and wonder about without food.
Okay, so he gives two examples here at the end of the chapter of chapter 38. And the first one is the lioness and her young cubs. And, you know, here is a lion, this massive beast that has to eat so much food per day, and it has to hunt. And so the rhetorical question again to Job here is, Job, how are you going to provide prey for the lion? How are you going to satisfy the appetite of the young whelps? I do this. Can you do that, Job? And so it's again more of the rhetorical questions to Job, that these young lions crouch in their dens. They are hungry and they need to be fed. And God sees to it that these massive animals, these great hunters, are provided prey that they can continue to live. And then he turns right around, though, in verse 41 and takes a very small animal. He takes then the raven. And he says, so he goes from the very large king of the animals to the very small raven. He says, well, Job, let's go on the other extreme. Do you provide food for the raven? How does the raven eat? And when it has its young ones that cry out in their nest and they're hungry and they wander about for lack of food, how do you do that? How do you provide for the birds? And so God goes from one extreme here at the start of this animate section to the other. So he goes from the king of the beasts, the lion, to the small ravens. And so this is how he begins then the animate kingdom as he talks to Job. Okay, any other thoughts?
It's interesting how he uses a raven to feed the lion.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I hadn't even thought about that. That's a very good point, Wayne. So from the powerful lion to the raven's young ones, they also implore God for food. He provides it, whether large or small. God is benevolent to all his creation. And so then he goes on to another interesting animal is the wild ox, or they call it the ibex. And these are a type of animal that generally live not in the presence of men. And so we'll read verses 39, verses 1 through 4. So I'm hearing a bell. Oh, it is. There it is. It's flashing. That means Bruce was going to read right now.
I have it on
airplane. That's in case Bruce fell asleep.
Oh, it was to wake Bruce up. Okay. So in verse 39, at chapter 38 and verse 1, he says, he moves on then from the lion to the raven. Now he goes to the wild goats. He says, do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear their young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? So do you know the gestation period? Do you know the time when they bear their young? They bow down. They bring forth their young. They deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy. They grow strong with grain, and they depart and do not return to them. So he gives an illustration now about the wild goat or the ibex. And these animals generally live away from the presence of men up in the mountains. And, you know, his questions are who would normally supervise their breeding into flocks. And God has given these animals the instinct to have their own unobserved and unsheltered protection in the mountains. And so he's asking, again, more rhetorical questions of, do you know the gestation period? Do you know when the young are born? Do you know how they are fed and so forth? And so he's continuing the same thread with these various animals. Beginning in verse 5, we're going to get into the what we call the wild donkey, and that's his next example to Job. So if I can get someone to read 5 through 8. 5 through 8. Okay, Kevin. Okay, so here's this wild donkey that roams free. He doesn't have any fence. He has his own life, and seemingly it's almost like he scorns civilization. Unlike the domesticated cousin, he is only relying on what God has given him, which is the open wild fields and pastures. And God has set this animal loose to be free. And so it's rather interesting. And I've if you haven't seen these, I know Kelly and I on some of our vacations down in the Nevada area, there are several areas where they have just wild donkeys just out running on the sides of the freeways, and it's rather interesting. They're rather scraggy looking, and they just run along the sides of the roads, and you can see them out in these herds. And there is no fence. They provide for themselves. They feed themselves, and they take care of their own shelter. And it's just fascinating. But that's another example God gives is, you know, who set the wild donkey free? And, you know, how does he take care of himself? And so, again, more rhetorical questions for Job, the wild donkey. Well, God moves on, and he talks about the next one is the wild ox. And beginning in verse 9, he says, will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because of his great strength? Or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it onto your threshing floor? And again, these are all rhetorical no's. Apparently the wild ox, or the auroch, and if I'm pronouncing that wrong, tell me, aurochs. Apparently they've been extinct since about 1627 was the last time one was seen. It was an enormous animal that was very, very powerful. It's said to be, you know, one of the most powerful animals they've seen of the hoofed beasts.
Well,
BJ.
The reason they're extinct is very similar to why we don't see much buffalo here today. They were hunted for sport. And in the Black Obelisk, if you remember Luke Chandler talking about that, Shalmaneser III, who was king of Assyria, that's one of the things that he boasts about on that, on his
obelisk.
On his inscription there is how many of these animals that he had hunted down and killed himself with his own hands. So it was a sport.
It was a sport.
And that's part of why they were extinct, but that also gives credibility to the power and what God's describing here is that God is the one who controls this massive animal that is hunted by the greatest of men.
And apparently it was a very, and I appreciate that because I didn't have that history on that. It was a very powerful animal, and what the commentator said of all the hoofed animals, it would, you know, or the large mammals, it would only be exceeded in size and power by the hippo and the elephant. And of course, the natural reference here is to Job is, you know, I, God, created these very, very powerful animals, and I created this very powerful wild ox. I'm a powerful God. What are you, Job? And so again, it's more rhetoric, but it's to get Job to be humbled as God explains his creation. So, but apparently this animal is extinct, unless they happen to find one here sometime in the near future. But the last one seen, according to the history I read on it, was back in the 1600s. And so, but it was very, very big, powerful animal. All right, the next one God talks about is the ostrich. And the way God talks about the ostrich, he's pretty stupid. He's a dumb animal. And so I get someone to read verses 13 through 18. Okay, Kevin.
The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love, for she abandons her eggs to the earth and warms them in the dust. And she forgets that a foot may crush them or that a wild beast may trample them. She treats her young cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is unconcerned. Because God has made her forget wisdom and has not given her a share of understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she laughs at the horse and his rider.
Okay, so God talks about this very interesting animal named the ostrich. And, you know, as we all know, some animals are useful to men and some appear to be have created just for God's entertainment and maybe ours. But it's really interesting. God, you know, such as the ostrich, while her speed is an asset, ostriches are very fast. They can outrun a horse. But treatment of her young is considered almost to the point of stupid and cruel. She will lay the eggs and just leave them and walk off. And and I guess the interesting point of this is, even so, if God is pleased to create a bird deficient in wisdom, so what? He's God, and He wants to make a bird that's silly like that and void of understanding. He is God, and so the ostrich is a very, very interesting animal. Any thoughts or comments on that before we move on? Okay, yeah, very, very interesting. It's almost humorous. From the ostrich, so you go from the sublime, now we go to the magnificent horse. And I know we got some horse lovers out here. And so let's go down and read verses 19 through 25. You want to get it for us? Thank you. Yeah.
Have you given the horse strength? Have you clothed his neck with thunder? Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He gallops into the clash of arms. He mocks at fear and is not frightened, nor does he turn back from the sword. The quiver rattles against him, the gilting spear and javelin. He devours the distance with fierceness and rage, nor does he come to a halt because the trumpet has sounded. At the blast of the trumpet, he says, aha! He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of captains and shouting.
Okay, so we go from the very silly animal, the ostrich, to this magnificent beast that has been used throughout history. Thank you, Jack, for reading that. And that's exonerated by God here. But a couple questions that God asks in the middle of this is, can you make such an animal? Can you control such an animal as this magnificent horse? And horses are used always in battle. And when you go in the Old Testament, you'll see the use of horses. The horses are described, the horses of the Babylonians, the horses of the Chaldeans and the Assyrians, as being fierce animals. And these animals were indeed used in very major battles. And so God is basically praising the majestic power and the majestic strength of the horse, and how he can run and how he can compete even in a battle situation. And so God is from one where he's kind of mocking the ostrich, to the other one, he's praising this magnificent animal, the horse. And so, as again, God's referring to another one of his creations. And so then we move on to the last couple, and then we'll be done for tonight, except for we'll talk just a little bit about Behemoth and Leviathan. But the next one is the hawk, and it's just a short reference to the hawk here. Verse 26 of chapter 39, he says, does the hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings towards the south? So again, a reference to the hawk and its instinctive migration patterns as they fly and migrate south. Job, where did they learn this? Oh, this came from God. And could Job do this? There's a big difference between man's limited mastery of his environment and God's total sovereignty of his creation. And so the illustration here is the hawk flies south by wisdom. Where did he get that wisdom? And it came from God. Of course, it's by what God has given them. And then the final example that God refers to is the eagle, and the majestic eagle. And if I get someone to read 27 through 30, that will be to the end of the chapter. So I get someone to read that for me. I need a reader. Okay, Mark in the back. Okay, so the final majestic creature is the eagle, and he talks about the fact, and we know this to be true, eagles make their nests up in the crags of the cliffs. They're usually way up high, and they have a tremendous ability to see a long distance to observe their prey. and then launch upon it and to feed its young. And so it's another example of God's magnificent creations. And he also refers to where the slain are, there it is. The eagle will often go and join in the feast of a downed animal. And was it at Job's command that this bird fly higher than about any other bird? Or was it by Job's command that they built their nest so high? The ability for this bird to live as it does, it's a gift from God. And so these are all things for Job to think about. And so the scenario continues in chapter 40, and we're going to pick up in chapter 40 next week. We'll finish the book, 40, 41, and 42. But one of the things that God asks in verse 1 of chapter 40, it says, "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, 'Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it.'" So again, he's saying, Job, you've wanted to contend with me. You wanted to meet me in court. You've wanted to lay things and charges at my feet. Are you going to correct me? You know, I am the designer and maker of, and all these last 18 things we've talked about, of the inanimate world and the animate world, are you going to correct me? And so that's kind of where we leave off, and for next week we will finish the book, chapter 40, 41, and 42. But God also, in the next two chapters, we'll talk about this next week, talks about two very mysterious animals, the behemoth in chapter 40 and the great Leviathan in chapter 41. And there's a lot of debate on what these animals are. So a lot of the commentaries wrestle with these animals. Some of the majority of commentaries believe that Behemoth was a hippo. And although I can make some arguments that there's some illustrations there that don't quite fit. But and the other one is the Leviathan, that most commentaries think it's the Nile crocodile. Some very, very interesting animals. And again, this is all part of God telling Job, I created these creatures by my command. What have you done? And so very, very interesting. Any thoughts or questions? Yeah.
I just think it's interesting that the first words out of God's mouth is putting Job in his place. And Job is in a terrible condition.
Suffering.
And if we were to be able to speak with God, would God immediately put us in our place before saying anything else?
Yeah. No, it's very interesting, and that's how God starts off chapter 38, is who is this? You know, who are you to bring counsel without knowledge? And so it's very John.
Well,